Enemy of the people. Who, me? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When President Trump calls the media the enemy of the people, even Nikita Khrushchev's great-granddaughter cringes because it reminds her of the past.
The language that even the Soviets, after the death of Joseph Stalin, actually dismissed, because even for the Soviets, that language was too divisive.
Plus, a Kansas City suburb is still reeling after an immigrant is shot and killed in a local bar, and some want President Trump to speak up about it.
We have to have a president who's willing to say, we value all people.
Plus, the Iranian-American scientists who held on to that Oscar for as long as they could.
But I couldn't bring it home. We had to give it back to the Academy for engraving.
The story's ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad to have you here on this Monday. We begin today with a story that's resonating from the American Midwest all the way to India. It started with a shooting last Wednesday at a bar in Olathe, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City. Two friends, both immigrants from India, were shot by a man who had earlier shouted at them to, quote, get out of my country. One of the victims was killed. The other was wounded, along with a third man at the bar who tried to intervene. The shooter fled but was later arrested. Police in Kansas are investigating it as a possible hate crime. News of the shooting traveled fast to India, where many people are wondering how safe Indian nationals are in the U.S. now. My colleague at the BBC, Rajini Vadyanathan, went to Kansas, where she spoke with the widow of Srinivas Kuchibotla and to Alok Madasani, the friend who survived. Here's Rajini's report.
People from all faiths have crammed into the chapel of the Olathe First Baptist Church to take part in a candlelight vigil. Many in attendance don't usually worship here and are from the city's small Indian community. Today's service is all about unity across race and religion. It was at the Austin's Bar and Grill across the road from the church that Srinivas Kuchibotla and Alok Madasani were enjoying a drink after work last Wednesday. Both were engineers with local tech company Garmin, who'd moved to the US from the city of Hyderabad in India. The best friends were regulars at the bar. As Alok explains, it was like any other night out.
It was a regular average Joe conversation, you know, nothing serious. And this guy just randomly comes up and, you know, starts pointing fingers.
What did he say?
He came towards me and said, which country are you from? Are you here illegally?
As the man was escorted inside, other eyewitnesses heard him shout, get out of my country. He left the bar, but later returned.
You're drinking beer, you're with your friend, you hear, next thing, he's back with a gun. And I heard a pop. Next thing I know, I was right on the ground. I just dove for my life. I heard 2-3 go off again. I was yelling for everybody, help, help, I got shot. I was, you know, trying to get up, and all I saw was Srinivas, you know, lying there motionless.
32-year-old Srinivas was killed in the attack.
His clothes are here. His side of the sink.
At the large suburban house they built together, Sunayana Dumala is grieving for her husband. As she invited me into her home, visitors were arriving to pay their final respects to him as his body lay covered in flowers.
When the recent elections happened, he was watching it so closely. I just couldn't sleep. I was talking to Srino, and then I was like, Srino, will we be safe in this country? I'm so worried. I think this hate crime will be more open now. Will it be safe for us to go to a mall? Will it be safe for us to go to office? I'm so worried. He hugged me like this and he said, Nani, don't worry. We should be okay.
Others in this tight-knit community share Sunayana's fears that the election fueled a more vocal anti-immigrant sentiment. When asked if this sort of rhetoric had contributed to the attack, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said any correlation was absurd. But Sunayana's called on President Trump to do more to combat hate crime.
This differentiation should be made that what is hate and what is love? The people who spread hate might be a 1% or 2% of the population. But because of them, the remaining 98% shouldn't be suffering.
Sunyana's now in India performing the last rites for the man she married 4 years ago. She wants to return to America, but like many of her friends, she wonders if she still belongs in the country her husband loved so dearly.
It's a question in everybody's mind that are they at the right place? Have they made the right decision of being in this country? But now I feel like I have to come back and show people here that you have taken away from me my love, but I'm here to spread love.
Sunyana Dumala there, ending that report from my colleague at the BBC, Rajini Vadyanathan. Sunyana is the widow of Srinivas Kuchibhotla, the man who was shot and killed last Wednesday in a bar just outside Kansas City. Louis Duguid knows the Kansas City area better than most. He spent nearly 40 years at the Kansas City Star, most recently as a columnist and a member of the paper's editorial board. We asked him for the backstory to what happened in Olathe.
Olathe is the county seat of Johnson County, Kansas. Johnson County is the wealthiest community in the Kansas City area. It's also one of the wealthiest suburbs in the country. Johnson County has developed over the years largely because of racial segregation and blockbusting that occurred and the exclusion of people of color. But what also is, I think, telling is the population of Olathe has been changing over the last few years so that it's becoming more and more diverse. People of different races, whether African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, and certainly people from other countries are settling in Olathe. Why? Because it is a very affordable suburb in the wealthiest county in the area with good schools and good housing. And why wouldn't people want to settle there?
Is there history that we're missing here, history of Kansas City, that can actually fill in some of the blanks to what happened and why this happened?
Well, keep in mind that Kansas City is the eighth most segregated community in the country, and it stands out for that racial segregation. This didn't happen overnight. This is something that has been festering for 100 years, and Kansas City didn't invent race covenants that restricted homeownership, but it certainly perfected it with people like J.C. Nichols and the Nichols Company beginning new suburbs, many of them in Johnson County, with the restrictions that no African Americans or other people of color could move into those areas. Now, this carried into the latter part of the 20th century, not so much as law, but certainly as a way things are. You combine that with blockbusting that occurred in Kansas City, and you can see that there's a huge problem.
Just remind us what blockbusting is.
Blockbusting is where a realtor or a realty company will go into an urban community and tell people who are white in that urban community that a black family has moved into the area. You need to sell your house immediately. And by the way, you can buy into these newer areas that are being developed in the suburbs for a higher price. Mm. Then once those individuals move, fearing that their property values will fall when African Americans move into an area, the realtors then jack the price up to market value and sell it to black families. So it allows for the deterioration of entire sections of the city. Now, what's taken place in Kansas City has been replicated all over the country. You can go to any city anywhere, whether it's St. Louis, Philadelphia, Boston, and see this same process that's taken place.
So one of the survivors in this attack is alleging that the attacker yelled at the two Indian men, "Get out of my country." What does this mean for immigrants in Kansas City?
That doesn't surprise me. Because of the anti-immigrant rhetoric that was stirred up in the presidential campaign, and that same theme has been a part of Donald Trump's presidency with stories that have talked about using the military to round up people who are here illegally.
Right. So it sounds like there are many things about Kansas City that kind of fall in line with the racial picture of the whole United States, and some particularities, too. The racial narrative that you've described, how does that play into kind of the changing face of Kansas City with these new immigrant arrivals?
Kansas City, about 20 years ago, became a new destination for a lot of immigrants who were coming in from Mexico and Central America and South America, as other places that had attracted those populations became more and more more hostile. And there were jobs there. There were families there. There was housing there. And so it became a place where people thought that they could establish themselves and live the American dream. But the problem is that every newcomer faces opposition, in many cases, from some of the folks who've been here a long time. There have been efforts in Kansas City to try to bridge the divide. Olathe certainly has worked as a city to calm some of the racial tension. But I think that what we're seeing now with the rhetoric coming out of Washington has changed the tone. It's allowed some people who have these anti-immigrant feelings to just act on it, and that's what is a problem.
Kansas City has several immigrant concentrations. There's also a sizable Arab community, right?
Absolutely. And it's a very strong, cohesive, and growing community. Garmin attracts people from overseas for different specialty jobs. And that's what happened with those individuals who were at the bar, just being friends, having a drink after work, the American thing.
So Kuchi Botla, the victim, and his wife moved here to work at Garmin, as you said, and there are other national brands like H&R Block and Hallmark also based in Kansas City. Will violence like this impact the city's ability to attract top talent?
There are many different groups in the Kansas City area that have constantly worked against this kind of violence. The Crescent Peace Society, which is a largely Muslim group, has worked against this type of anti-immigrant sentiment since the 1990s after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, and people instantly thought that it was something that someone who was Muslim had done when it was a domestic terrorist. I think that these groups, combined with some of the efforts of other groups, churches, community centers, governments, are really going to step up, and they have to step up, to prevent this kind of violence from recurring.
Yeah, have Hindus and Muslims in Kansas City historically stood together in the past?
There's a coming together that has occurred in the Indian and the Muslim communities to try to put people's fears at rest. And what we're talking about is a fear of the other.
Finally, I think it's worth mentioning that President Trump has not mentioned this attack and this murder at all. How are immigrant communities in Kansas City responding to that? And how should we all interpret that?
President Trump was supported by groups like the KKK and other white nationalist organizations. And I think that he's going to have to figure out whether those are the groups that he wants to side with, or if he wants to side with the majority of Americans who don't want this kind of hate to continue in our country. America has been a nation that's been rooted in the exploitation of African Americans and of Native Americans and of every immigrant group that has come here. But I think that we have to find a way to get past this. Our world is too small.
Louis Duguid spent 40 years writing about race and other issues for the Kansas City Star. He stepped down in October. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We should note that while Trump did receive support from the KKK and other white supremacist groups, he has in the past publicly disavowed them. I mentioned earlier that the shooting in Kansas has reverberated far and wide. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear from an Indian American medical student here in Boston who feels impacted by what happened in Kansas. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. President Trump, as you probably know, likes to rail against the fake news media. That's his term for news outlets he doesn't like the New York Times and CNN, among others. And then there's that other phrase he likes to use when talking about the media. Here's a moment from Trump's speech last week to conservative activists and politicians gathered in Washington.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
Nina Khrushcheva is a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She's also the great-granddaughter of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. And in Russia, she says, the phrase enemy of the people has a dark history.
When I was growing up, that phrase was never used. It was only used in historical context. It really began when the Bolsheviks, or when the dictatorship of proletariat was being created in Russia, and it was used by mostly by the Bolshevik party, because their idea is that they're really trying to create this great brotherhood on earth. And therefore, anybody who present a little bit less drastic view, they would brand the enemy of the people. It was used to some degree, it was used by Leon Trotsky. It was used by Vladimir Lenin, because anybody, as I said, against them would be the enemy. But it was really ratcheted up during Joseph Stalin, because for him, it became a very convenient political tool. So when you just say so-and-so could be the enemy of the people, then you really don't have to look into any context or even any crimes. You just say, you know, somebody would report that you don't wink the right way, and that would be enough to really prosecute you. Mm. So that's how gulags were created. And then, you know, when Donald Trump does use it in the context of American democracy, you know, you kind of get goosebumps.
So your great-grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, actually wanted the phrase enemy of the people eliminated. Did it become so toxic? Because, like, if you said somebody was an enemy of the people, that would send them to a gulag or even have them eliminated?
Well, it wouldn't be sent during Khrushchev, obviously, because he denounced gulags and closed them for the most part. So that wouldn't be the case in the mid-late 50s and 60s and further on. So as I said, when I was growing up, that was never used. But yes, even, I mean, that's the sort of the tragedy of Trump, is that even the Soviets in the middle of its history in the 50s and 60s decided that that phrase is too toxic, too tragic, too unbearable. And also, I mean, you know, as communists are good propagandists, they also know that name calling or words actually create reality. And that's one of the reasons that Khrushchev decided to denounce the phrase that would send people to gulags. So that's another thing that I'm very nervous about the Trump administration, is that they may not understand the reality of those words, but they certainly create an atmosphere that could lead to violence, could lead to really horrible, very tragic consequences.
So as a Russian, what's your advice for us Americans when we think about these phrases that are so potent?
I've been thinking about that, and I would make my students do now. I just say, you know what, sound bites really not working out for you. So I would really advise you to go back and read books. And I would actually start with totalitarian books. So let's read George Orwell, 1984. Let's read Vladimir Nabokov, Ben Sinister. Let's read Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. And, you know, it goes from there.
What is, by the way, the phrase in Russian for enemy of the people? How do you say it?
Враг народа.
Враг
народа.
Oh,
it sounds, you know, now when I said it in Russian, it sounds horrifying.
I'm sorry to re-traumatize you.
Thank you. America is traumatized right now.
Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev. She's also a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm not quite sure how to transition to this next story, but here goes. You might have seen this. There is this tubby, gray, sort of drooping creature with glazed eyes on social media. Imagine a cross between a sulking elephant and the Poppin' Fresh Doughboy. What's really curious is where this character comes from and who loves him now. Newsweek reporter Damian Sharkov has written about the gray blob. Where does it come from?
Well, originally he comes from Holland, strangely enough. His official name really is Homunculus loxodontus. It's a Latin name, and it pretty much indicates that he is kind of fictional mix between a humanoid creature and elephant seal.
All right, so this fictional creature was actually the product of the imagination of a Dutch artist. What was her intent before it kind of migrated to Russia?
Dutch artist Margaret Brevoort actually created the creature to be a sculpture for a hospital waiting room so it can liven up any patients who are there, children in particular, but wanted to design something that wasn't too much of an eyesore for anybody there receiving bad news. But in Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, it's taken off as a meme, and it has kind of a life and a different name of its own. In Russia, he's known as Zhdun. In Ukraine, he's known as Puchikun.
So before we go any further, Damien, just describe this creature. What does it look like?
It is a gray blob. It does look slightly like a seal. It has these simplistic glazed eyes. One thing that's quite noteworthy about it is that it doesn't have any feet. As it's intended to embody the spirit of waiting, it's kind of cynical that it has to wait because it can't really walk away. So right. When you see it mounted on a seat, it's pretty apparent that that's a creature that's there to stay kind of indefinitely.
So how did it catch on in Russia? Why is it so popular there?
Well, I started spotting it as a meme where it first started appearing on a Russian website called Peekaboo. It's a social media website. And there, people really picked up on this creature that's prepared to wait a long time, it being well-meaning, but maybe looking a bit simple, a bit optimistic in the face of maybe hopelessness. And people have been sharing images of it pasted next to Vladimir Putin with captions like waiting for the next election or next to other politicians or next to large construction projects waiting their completion. It's really become the symbol of waiting for Godot, if you will, for Russians.
Any funny examples of Zhdun, the gray blob, and how he's being used in Russia?
There's plenty of funny examples. I think most recently in Ukraine, there was a very funny example where one MP...
Oh, he's caught on in Ukraine as well, huh?
He is, yeah. In Ukraine, though, he's known as Pochekun, which also means somebody who waits.
Pochekun.
In Ukrainian, yeah. So one MP took a small toy of Pochekun or Zhdun to Parliament to complain about some of his colleagues not being there.
So they had Zhdun, like, in the seat of the colleague who wasn't there. Like, he's going to now pass the laws.
Yeah, the caption, I believe, was waiting for other MPs to turn up.
Yeah, waiting for Godot, waiting for the next presidential election. It seems like the common thing about Elephant Man or Zhdun or the Gray Blob, whether it's Ukraine, Russia, or the Netherlands, is that he's just this thing caught in an existential state of boredom. Am I wrong?
That is an interesting way of putting it. Definitely the boredom aspect has been played up very much in Ukraine and in Russia. But yes, I think you're right. There's a political scientist in Russia who recently wrote about it in Russia, and he basically said the Russian Zhdun has kind of become the new political symbol of the country because he's well-meaning, sluggish maybe, always anticipating reforms and improvements to come to Russia, but he's not really prepared to go out and instigate some revolutionary changes if those reforms aren't made.
Damian Sharkov with Newsweek. Thanks very much for telling us about Zhdun, the gray blob. Great stuff.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman. 30 years ago, the term world music was coined, and Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart was already primed to dive in.
I was always encouraged in the band to try new things and take it out of what they called rock and roll.
My conversation with Mickey Hart about world music, that's ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Everyone's still talking about the La La Land Moonlight mix-up. But to me, the most interesting moment at the Oscars last night was when Iran's The Salesman won for Best Foreign Language Film. Iranian director Asghar Farhadi was not there to accept the award for his movie. He stayed away to protest President Trump's travel ban. Instead, he asked two famous Iranian scientists here in the U.S. to go in his place. Anousheh Ansari, the first Iranian in space, read a short statement from the director on stage.
Dividing the world into the us and our enemies categories creates fear, a deceitful justification for aggression and war. Filmmakers can turn their cameras to capture shared human qualities and break stereotypes of various nationalities and religions. They create empathy between us and others, an empathy which we need today more than ever.
Also on stage to accept the award with Ms. Ansari was Firouz Naderi, a former NASA director for solar system exploration. He says he was just as surprised as anyone when Farhadi asked him to attend the Oscars forum. Naderi says he'd never had any contact with the director before this.
There are prominent Iranian-American actors and actresses that he could have selected to represent him, and one wonders why he selected two people associated with space. Possibly. The reason is that once you go away from the Earth into the space and look back at Earth, you see it as a single blue marble. You see no borders, no lines separating people. Maybe because he wanted to express his opposition to the travel ban, he thought that that would be a powerful metaphor, I'm guessing.
That's a great and poetic sentiment, but you really don't have any idea why he asked the two of you to be there.
No, except for the fact that he wanted two people who were well known in Iran. But no.
What was it like being there in the audience with all this glitterati?
Well, you know, not my world. you know, so, you know, I have faced the world press when we landed on Mars. So in terms of, you know, the atmosphere, the excitement, different, but something that I've experienced before in a different context.
So he sent you and Ms. Ansari comments that he wanted read. Were there things that you wanted to say that he hadn't written down?
My really strongest interest in participating is that I'm most worried about the students who've been affected by this, either Iranian students who have visas and applications to go to school here, or people who were here, went back to visit family, and now cannot get back. And, you know, just thinking as an American, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot. The Iranian students that come from good technical universities in Iran are coveted by Stanfords and MITs because they are brilliant. And once they come here, one or two things will happen. Either they will get their PhDs and decide to stay in this country, which is good for American workforce, or decide to go back to Iran and take back with them a certain level of empathy for America. Either possibility is good. So why do we want to keep students from coming and furthering their education?
So, Fairuz Naduri, what's your own story about coming to the United States?
I came here a long time ago on student visa in 1964. Then because I had an obligation, since a bit of my PhD was financed by Shah's government then, I had obligated myself to go and work it off for 3 years. And I did. I went back there in 1976 and did my 3 years, and that coincided with the revolution in 1979. And essentially, the new government came, and there was a wave of anti-intellectualism in Iran, and they said, this is not your country. You're free to leave.
Wow. You've been part of that migration of Iranian students for a long time then. Who has the actual Oscar award today, and how will you get it to Mr. Farhadi?
I held on to it as long as I could, but I couldn't bring it home. We had to give it back to the Academy for engraving. And I assume the Academy will see to it that he gets it.
Dr. Fairuz Naduri at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Southern California, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
People come to the U.S. to study and to work and to live from many countries, of course, among them India. Earlier on the show today, we discussed the fatal shooting last week in Olathe, Kansas, which resulted in the death of Srinivas Kuchibhotla. He was an Indian citizen who came to the U.S. to study and then worked for Garmin, the company, as an engineer. News of his fatal shooting reverberated in India, but also here in the U.S. among Indian Americans. Siva Sundaram is a medical student at Harvard here in Boston. He wrote about the attack for USA Today. Siva grew up one state over from Kansas in Rockford, Illinois. His parents are Hindu immigrants from India. So Siva, like the victim in the Olathe shooting, Srinivas Kuchibhotla, you're neither Muslim nor Middle Eastern, but I gather in the years since 9/11, some Americans haven't always known the difference.
That's right. And the funny thing is, I don't think that ever really bothered me. I had felt a certain sense of security being a young person who spoke without an accent. It didn't matter to me much if I was mistaken as Muslim, because I thought, what's wrong with that?
So you said you had been mistaken for being Muslim a couple of times. Tell us about those times. What were they like?
The first that I remember was shortly after I moved to Salt Lake City after growing my beard. I walked into this grocery store, like an Indian Pakistani grocery store, and a man with a much more impressive beard than mine greeted me, Salaam Alaikum, and began to utter the rest of the greeting. And what I could recognize was Urdu, a language I don't speak. And my thought was, I feel close to you. I feel that you are looking at me as someone who is one of you and trying to make a connection. And I wish I could respond in kind, but now I recognize you. I see you. It was more of a pleasant thing than anything to see. Like, this is an attempt of human connection. That,
right. Mistaken identity in a good way.
Exactly.
So when you heard about this shooting in Olathe, how did you react?
It took a toll on me. it hit me harder than I expected it to. I think the question gets at what it is to be human, maybe as a young male who sort of feels invincible. I never really thought that the danger applied to me. And I think that's a dynamic that we see in a broader form when all of us who could be targeted for some reason or the other feel relatively safe and sort of find it easier just to live our lives rather than trying to make a change.
You feel less safe today than you did a week ago. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
So tell me a bit about your parents and how they ended up in the Midwest and how their own journey shaped your identity.
My parents were both educated in India as an engineer and an architect. And my dad came to the U.S. to get a master's degree in business. Neither of them really planned to stay, but it so happened that they had my brother. They needed to find jobs, and jobs were in Northern Illinois. Northern Illinois was an interesting place to grow up Indian American because the community was there, but it wasn't huge. And so I felt like being Indian was not that central to who I was. It was just one of a number of things about me. That first and foremost, I was Siva, the kid who did well in school, or Siva, the kid on the basketball team, not Siva, the Indian kid.
Mm. So what do you make of the national response to the shooting in Olathe?
I think the response has not been that visible. It's hard to tell these days. It's hard to know what the national conversation really is because we're all filtering through our Facebook news feeds, and that seems like the world to us.
But you're saying that the response hasn't been visible, as in it should be getting more attention, but it's not?
I would think so. I would expect my voice to not be one of the few that I've seen out there. And I think part of what people are struggling with is that we know so little about what actually happened.
Mm.
I'm not standing here trying to like level allegations of this was definitely a hate crime against someone who looks like me. I think it's a complicated story.
Where does all of this leave you, considering, as you wrote so wonderfully in your USA Today column a few years ago, you grew a beard and your father suggested you ought to shave it. What do you think today about his advice?
You know, on the one hand, that part of me that feels invincible is still alive, and I still have all these reasons in my head that it won't actually happen to me. And there's another part of me that feels like it's actually quite important for me not to change anything about the way I live my life.
Why?
Right now. I have this hope that if I can continue to be me as a person who defies and cuts across different kinds of stereotypes. You know, I can look like someone who might be Muslim, but I have a Hindu background. I view that as a personal political step to try to encourage everyone to not put such stock in these stereotypes.
Siva Sundaram is a medical student at Harvard. Thanks very much for coming here.
Thank you.
If you want to read an excerpt from Siva's USA Today piece, just go to PRI.org. Stuff that is old is new again. That's perhaps a good definition of retro. Vinyl records, the VW Beetle. And I know you love your smartphone, but now a revamped version of the Nokia 3310 has just launched, nearly 17 years after eager fingers started punching its keypad. The Nokia 3310 is nicknamed the Brick. Nothing stylish about it, really. Back in 2003, Nokia sold it as rugged, indestructible, solid design, and unique buttons, along with its distinct ringtone. Yeah, you remember it now. The Nokia 3310 became very popular before it was phased out in 2005, but now the Brick is back. Ian Bogos is a professor of media studies and computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. You remember the Nokia 3310, Ian? Did you ever own one?
I definitely remember it. I had an earlier Nokia model, the 6190, which was from about 1997. But I remember the 3310 so well, thanks to that asymmetrical button layout and
right.
The color case options. And that distinctive style is such that I think anyone who remembers it couldn't fail to recall it later, you know, like a classic car or a landmark building. It kind of burns its form into your mind.
Yeah, sure. So 17 years is a long time. What have been the updates?
Well, it has a color screen now for one part, which is bigger than the original kind of green and black screen that you might remember from the early days. And the handset's thinner than it once was. You can slip it into your pocket more easily. Comes with a camera, which the original didn't. It has a more capacious battery. Nokia claims that it can go like 22 hours of talk time or something like that.
So what's the appeal of the new Nokia other than it being retro?
Well, you know, the market for phones like this hasn't vanished, even though we don't talk about it very much. It's certainly been supplanted largely by smartphones, but there were about 1 million phones of this sort that were sold in the UK last year. When you have a phone like this that's cheap, it's rugged, it's simple, it's, you know, might be better suited for certain users and uses than a smartphone would be. And then there's also the fact that at this moment, this year, there are a lot of people, including myself, I don't know about you, who maybe feel a little too attached to their smartphones. Mm. Maybe
I know
the time
what you're
is
talking
right.
About. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we'd like not to be reachable all the time.
Right. So for people like us who want to kind of get off the grid, other than us, who's the target audience? Is it the developing world? Because I actually did buy one of these Nokias 4 years ago in Senegal precisely for this reason.
The developing world remains a major market, but for those in the developed world, there are other reasons to consider a product like this. Maybe you want a phone for emergencies or to leave in the car, and that was actually one of the reasons that many people bought cell phones back in the 2000 era anyway. Maybe you want one to take with you when you go camping or you go rafting somewhere where you're afraid that your $1,000 phone might get damaged. Maybe you want to take one to a concert, a sporting event where it could get stolen. You just don't want to worry about it.
Well, on the timescale of technology, it's not exactly sophisticated, but the Finns were really proud of it when it came out, the Nokia 3310.
It's important to remember that there was a time around the 2000s, early 2000s, when Nokia had the vast majority of the handset market all around the globe. And to get a cell phone really meant getting a Nokia, more or less. So returning to that moment, it's almost poetic. It feels like, you know, the underdog rising to defeat the overlord. There's a kind of David and Goliath story here, too.
Even though, as one Finn told me a few years ago, it's weird. Finns are some of the least talkative people on Earth.
It's true. And, you know, you go back and you look at the long history of Nokia, and I think it started as a paper company or something like that. So the longevity of the brand and also the business with a small industrial market. In some sense, Nokia needs to succeed for the local economic reasons in addition to global ones.
Ian Bogos, Professor of Media Studies and Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
2017 is the 30th anniversary of world music, and by that I mean it was in 1987 that the term world music was first used as a distinct category of music. So to mark this 30th anniversary, we're checking in with some of the artists who first embraced the term and the global sounds that go with it to reflect on what this thing, world music, is. Today, percussionist Mickey Hart, whose album Planet Drum won the very first Grammy for world music back in 1991. Mickey Hart's passion for beats was first fostered in his childhood home in New York City, then explored as the drummer for the Grateful Dead. But it really coalesced when he recorded Planet Drum. Hart has an insatiable curiosity for the way people around the globe have been making sounds since the beginning of time. And on Planet Drum, he just wanted to jam with other like-minded percussionists like Giovanni Hidalgo from Puerto Rico and Zakir Hussain from India. Hart says there was never a concerted effort to sit in the studio and make world music.
Oh, no, there's no such thing as world music, DeMarco. It's the world's music. I mean, there's no definition of world music. Music comes from all over, and it was just the right time for the world to express itself, because indigenous music has been neglected, very neglected. It wasn't even considered a music. It was just time for all of this music to make its appearance, and I was just at the nexus of it. I knew all of these drummers. I had played with them all independently. They didn't know each other. But I knew the sensibilities of each one of them, and I knew that they could work together. Therefore, I made the call. You know, it was a call to drummers, actually.
Right.
And I picked the best, you know, Ayerto, Zakir, Giovanni. I mean, just these were the creme de la creme.
when you look back on it, was your own curiosity something that was, you know, just a function of the multicultural city where you grew up? Or was it really about who you, Mickey Hart, were as a listener, as somebody who wanted to hear percussion?
The music made me who I am. So when I was a youngster, I ran into some pygmy music through my mother's collection. She had Count Basie, the Duke Ellington, in this collection that she had inherited. And in the middle of it, there they were, pygmy music, Ituri rainforest music, actually.
So from rare recordings of pygmies to the Grateful Dead, what was this space that the Grateful Dead gave you where you could play with some of these sounds that were in the back of your mind?
Well, Grateful Dead became a playground. I was always encouraged in the band to try new things and take it out of what they called rock and roll and became what now they call a jam band.
So when you had a drum solo, were you consciously thinking, I know the song is in 4-4 time, but I'm just going to break out of that for a few minutes and do some Turkish 11-16 time signature thing?
Well, we're a dance band, and I never broke the rhythm. I never tried to break the groove, but there was always a time in our night where it got really just went out there, out of the box, out of the 4-4 box, and everybody did it simultaneously and go to spaces musically that was a dream space, impossible stuff that we made possible by jumping out of the box, by going into nines and tens and 7-4, 5-4, 102.5, 205 beats. All these kind of things became natural to us. And therefore, the Grateful Dead morphed into what is called Grateful Dead music.
So you've been playing world music all your life in a way. What have, though, all the global music idioms that you've encountered, what have they done to you, not as a musician, but as a person?
Well, it certainly has stretched my imagination, and it made me think of what music is. I mean, when you hear a sound that you don't recognize, it calls it noise. But when it does understand that sound, it calls it music. So I've stretched my ear. I'm a man with a stretched ear, and I've done it. You really have to do that to enjoy the world's music, but you got to go after it. You know, I am on the board at Smithsonian Folkways. I work at the Library of Congress as well, and, you know, supporting indigenous music, transferring and putting them into digital forms so it could be shared by the whole world, because culturally they're very important. And it also tells us who we were and who we are. So I really respect the world's music. I play it. And I know that Pete Seeger used to call me up in the middle of the night and he'd say, I have long messages on my machine. And he would always say that music is the only energy that will save this planet, to save people, you know, save the universe, to be able to use that energy in a positive way, to understand what's going on around you. That's the power, man. That's really, as Bob Marley would say, music have plenty power. And he's right. You got to consume it. You got to become part of it. And then once you stop becoming a listener and you participate in that music, then you feel the power of the music, like a great symphony or a great song or a great soloist. That's what you have to do. You have to give your ear to it, and you have to deep listen. Once you deep listen, you do some deep listening, then you fall in love for the first time, every time.
Well, Mickey Hart, there's a great lesson there for this 30th anniversary of the phrase world music. Stretch your ears. I like that. Mickey Hart, great to speak with you. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thanks a lot.
That's percussionist Mickey Hart, drummer with the Grateful Dead, still massively curious about the rhythms of the planet. We'll be speaking with more musicians throughout the year about the phrase world music, a term, love it or hate it, coined 30 years ago this year. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.